from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on this morning's second Forum Hour, when he first visited Beijing in 1975, Orville Schell noticed a country that lacked advertisements, private cars, and private property. Today, China possesses the world's second largest economy, and Orville Schell, director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society, will join us along with his co-author John Delurie, a senior fellow at the center, to discuss how China rapidly climbed the global economic ladder, which they write about in their new book, Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. We'll talk with them about that history as well as where China is headed. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program, our second hour. China experts Orville Schell and John Delurie join us this hour to discuss China past, present, and future. And in their book, Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century, they chronicle China's rise to becoming one of the world's wealthiest and most powerful nations, actually the second most economic power in the world now. Former dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley and widely published author, Orville Schell is presently the Arthur Ross Director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the New York City-based Asia Society. His co-author, John Delurie, was Associate Director of Asia Society's Center on U.S.-China Relations and presently is Assistant Professor of Near Eastern Studies at Tonsai University in Seoul, South Korea. Both Orville Schell and John Delurie join us in studio for this hour. And before I officially welcome them, I want to say that in their book, they really present an argument. I want to just put this out first that, you know, Napoleon said when China's asleep, maybe the world is a lot more safe. That China has definitely awakened and we can feel the trembling all across the globe because something that goes all the way back to feeling of humiliations in the 19th century led to China's awakening and led to the fact that China has become this enormous powerhouse. So I want to welcome both Orville Schell. Welcome, Orville Schell, back to Forum.
Pleasure.
Good to have you. And John Delurie.
Thank you.
Good to have you both. This is really a story that, and we'll get to the kind of the naysaying now about China's being as powerful perhaps as many have been seeing it and as certainly you make the case. But this is a book kind of based on the 11 chosen. And I would say that there's a historical theory behind this that individuals, especially iconic figures, make history, which is always been kind of a moot point among historians. Is it the individuals or is it the cultures or is it, you know, as Marx would say, just economic forces or whatever? You seem to be behind the individual theory of history here.
Well, I think it's fair to say that individuals have a very prominent role in making history, but even more important, I think, for historians who are trying to plumb how the past connects with the present, they reflect what people thought and how thought was evolving. So you can use them both as sort of mirrors, as well as looking for their sort of catalytic effect on making history happen.
And let me go to you on this, John Delurie. I mean, there's a sense that the history goes all the way back to really China having capitulated to Great Britain after the Great Opium Wars, and you can almost see a trajectory there of that sense of shame and humiliation and China having things imposed on them. And that's really key to your thesis here about China wanting to get back their sense of power and wealth, for respect almost, really.
Yeah, I mean, the important point we're trying to make, and you have to go through the history to make this point, to people who are only seeing China in the last few years or even the last few decades of this rising power, is you have to go back 200 years to see how, you know, around 1800, China legitimately thought of itself as the center of its known world. You know, it was the dominant military and economic power in Asia, and a pretty extraordinary power at that. And so to understand then the sudden demise really across the course of the 19th century and how it finally picks back up now, without seeing that arc, we think you can't really appreciate some of the psychological complexity of China now as it rises back to a position of a kind of preeminence.
And Orville, of these 11 figures, and we'll talk about them, you have names that are certainly recognizable by many, like Sun Yat-sen and Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong. But there are also some names that people probably aren't that familiar with, including the first one in terms of, you know, shaping Chinese history in the present, Wei Yuan. beginning of an embodiment of Chinese history.
Well, he was an intellectual who was sort of groping during the middle of the 19th century to understand, you know, why was China becoming weak and unable to defend itself? And who were these people that were arriving, namely Great Britain and then France and everybody else? You know, how did they get so powerful? How did China suddenly become this sort of hapless case who couldn't defend itself? So he was sort of like the blind man feeling the elephant. He couldn't speak any foreign language. He'd never been abroad. There are a few things translated by Western missionaries, and he's trying to figure out, you know, who were these people? What did China need to do to remain at least equal, if not superior? And it was the beginning, as John suggested, of this long sort of agonizing slide from preeminence into complete ignominy.
And you can see, I guess, through these national iconic figures that you, a kind of national psyche, a kind of collective psyche, I think is sort of underlying the thesis here. And John, they also had to give up territory. One thinks about Germany after the Second World War. One thinks about the Confederacy. I mean, there's that sense of needing to compensate for having the will of other sovereign nations imposed upon one.
No, that's absolutely right. And another sometimes disturbing analogy is you can see we discuss the history of the unequal treaties, you know, and this is something that any Chinese person knows about, the unequal treaties that we've suffered under, that we, the Chinese, have suffered under. And, you know, in some ways, each one of these treaties is sort of like a mini Versailles, where after defeating China on the battlefield, an imperial power, first Western powers, but then Japan, really, you know, squeezed the lemon in the wound by making China financially, by crippling China financially. So essentially they lost the war and then had to pay the cost of the victor and funding the victor's next campaign in China. So China got caught in that cycle. That in some ways I think you can compare in terms of the impact it had, like you say, psychologically to some of the things that Europe saw post-World War One.
I need to make an announcement now. Bradley Manning was acquitted of aiding the enemy for giving secrets to the enemy, but he was found guilty on most other charges. He'll get life in prison, but he's guilty of downloading classified information and giving it to the public. And we will talk about that, not giving it to the public, excuse me, and we will talk about that in more specifics tomorrow during our first hour of forum. Orville Schell, there was a decision early on, in fact, to kind of take or borrow. I mean, China's still taking from the West cyber secrets and all that. But I mean, to go into the scientific and technical advantages that the West had and pretty much avail themselves.
Well, you know, in the pre-global world, particularly in a country like China, which was sufficient unto itself and didn't really see any need to borrow anything from anybody else, it came as quite a shock when the superior West with their gunboats and superior military technology arrived, and China had to begin contemplating what was a humiliating prospect to learn from these Western barbarians. And so it was a very slow process of slowly kind of wrenching themselves around to the point where they could do it, all the while, of course, being quite fearful that borrowing from the West would undermine and collapse, as it finally did, China's traditional culture, its traditional form of imperial rule with an emperor and a bureaucracy, imperial bureaucracy. So this was the beginning of the disassembly, not only of a culture and a sovereign country, but of a whole sort of psychology of the feeling of we are the best to. We are rather
call it Chinese chauvinism. We're no longer going to be the sick man of Asia. We're going to be healthy and robust and powerful and wealthy. Yeah, John.
Well, and this is ironic because now, as you reference, you know, China is criticized for borrowing too much or too easily, whereas historically—
Or lending too much in the case of the United States.
Yeah, right, that as well. But this issue of technology transfer, you know, intellectual property rights, historically, as we discussed, China's problem was always its fear of borrowing. And initially that came from a kind of arrogance, thinking there was nothing they would need to borrow. At later stages, it came from actually a quite legitimate concern that if China borrowed too much, it would jeopardize its national security. You know, so there was modern technology like the telegraph. Well, in the later 19th century, and the Chinese, how are you going to introduce the telegraph without hiring all these foreigners to build your telegraph system, to run your telegraph system. And now you've opened up your communications to your enemy. And you can see that with many of the technological improvements, leaps they knew they needed to make, but then these caused raging debates over the national security implications.
It's also a real tension that you write about at length in your book between the nationalism on the one hand and the advancement and movement toward different forms of, I suppose, interpreting Marx in one way or Lenin in one way or another, and the Confucian culture. And that remains a kind of strong dichotomy and binary, does it not?
You know, I think you could say that China went from being a country that was bound together by its culture, its Confucian culture, to one that had that all collapse around its ears and then had to kind of reinvent itself by finding a kind of new nationalism. And that's what Sun Yat-sen was all about. He described China as a dish of loose sand, a sheet of loose sand, you know, totally disaggregated. And he said that, you know, nationalism is the sweetest and most essential thing a country can have. And of course, China didn't have it, but it got it. And it got it with a vengeance. And it is a tremendous temptation even today for the government to turn to nationalism when it feels threatened or feels weak at home.
It's kind of family versus state in many ways. But you also have this phenomenon that really is fascinating of the Cultural Revolution almost paving the way, as you both seem to argue, for the kind of changes that took place economically.
Yeah, and this could be, you know, we're curious to see the reaction of this part of our argument, especially from Chinese as they read the book.
Because, a lot of chatter about that now.
Right. Sure. And, of course, the Cultural Revolution, you know, from roughly 1966 until Mao died in 1976 is one of the most sensitive topics, although surprisingly there's much more open discussion of it in China than one might think. There's a whole genre of memoirs, you know, Cultural Revolution memoirs, but still there are taboos. So, you know, our take on the Cultural Revolution will certainly stir up the pot of discussion in China, because in no ways do we defend it or say it was a good thing. But I think what we do is looking very coldly at China's progression through modern history. One effect we see of the Cultural Revolution and of Mao's excesses, you know, the revolutionary excesses to which he went, is that it was a kind of exorcism that got rid of this obsession with culture, also destroyed some of the elements of traditional culture that were holding the country back, but also got rid of the obsession with culture. And then in walks Deng Xiaoping. And Deng basically says, I'm not interested in culture one way or the other. I'm interested in economic development. And that is still, you know, the blueprint.
That's the trajectory that China remains on. It's also fascinating to think, though, of and you pointed out a number of different occasions of how the Westerners will look at China and think there's been all this extraordinary advancement economically, although we can talk about things that Paul Krugman and others are saying about the present. But there's been all this advancement, and all of it notwithstanding, you know, human rights repression, non-democratic government. They don't seem to go together in many people's minds, of course, and perhaps they don't. And yet for China, they are the exception that may prove what, a different kind of rule?
Well, this is the great conundrum.
Literally a different kind of rule.
Yeah, I mean, so this is the question. Has China kind of managed to establish some new kind of model for developments, authoritarian capitalism, Leninist capitalism, that defies the old verity that as one opens markets, one needs to open political structures too, because the two have to go in parallel. We used to think that. And it's at least until to date, that's not really proved to be true. China has managed to have one of the most extraordinary periods of economic growth, 2.5 decades. And nobody, such as myself, standing in the middle of Tiananmen Square in 1989 when the demonstrations were taking place, could have imagined this would happen.
Was that you in front of the tank, Orville Schell? It's a whole new movie.
I hope not. but it did happen. And so the question is, and we do try to wrestle with this a bit, is this a whole new way of going about developing a country? Should Africa listen up? Or is this a stage, just a stage, on the way to something else?
Cuba's listening up. I mean, just to name one obvious example. And
of course, Michael, this happens, this extraordinary period of economic growth, at precisely the time that the West, with all its vaunted proven models, is failing. Europe is kind of on the brink, America's been through a couple of collapses. So it's a very interesting kind of reorientation that everybody has to make in their sort of the developmental model, a part of their brain.
It's a pragmatism that really separates it from, let's say, the Soviet model. In fact, there are many things that separate it from the Soviet model. But also, I couldn't help thinking as I was reading through your work about the separation that there's a different work ethic in Chinese civilization. I mean, there really is. And one can hardly ignore it.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it reminds me of one of the early Western observers, sort of philosophical observers of China, was Montesquieu. And I once went through the spirit of the laws, you know, what is that, mid-18th century. And there's quite a bit on China. And one of the things Montesquieu really keeps going back to is that issue of work ethic. And he links it actually to the discussion we're having about democracy, because he says these people work so hard and are trying so hard economically that they don't share our sort of spirit of civil liberty. You know, they don't have that desire to participate. And of course, he was about republicanism and participation. So, you know, we don't get into Montesquieu in the book, but we do certainly, you know, show how in the most recent period, you know, in the last 30 years, all of this energy, this restless energy that China had throughout the preceding so-called century of humiliation, that in many ways was always misguided, finally, starting in the late 1970s, has a clear direction to it, which is work hard and make money for yourself and your family. And it's not a purely selfish materialism, because still the Chinese family survived these onslaughts. So it's also about your family, your extended family, and your children. But focusing on work, considering the poverty that China, you know, still suffers under, but certainly did 30 years ago. Again, this is an issue that makes sense for the historical stage that it's at in trying to get back to, as the title of our book says, wealth and power. You know, this is happening on a micro level across the country.
So how, I mean, we've got two of the leading scholars on China right here in the studio with us, but, you know, the question that immediately surfaces in many people's minds, how do two Caucasians become experts on Asians and specifically the Chinese? And does the outsider, does that give you maybe even an advantage of a different sort, or is it something you feel self-conscious about, or how do you respond to that?
Well, I think, you know, Caucasians, whenever they stumble into any aspect of Chinese life, if they really get into the interstices, you know, you're always noticed. you can't be in mufti for very long. So, I mean, there always is a kind of a membrane between us and them. And this is part of sort of the unique sort of a cultural attribute of China, that it was always very self-contained. I think for us, one of the nice things about doing this project and writing this book was that we've done a lot of reporting in the field, but in this case, we could go back and just read books and go back through this history, which we've both spent our lives in, but which never made a hell of a lot of sense to us.
Isn't that a great luxury? You know, whenever you do that, and then you feel, I have to actually write? Can I just sit here and read and continue to read? You get that feeling when...
To not be out there sweating it out in some marsh in 110 degrees in the middle of the Chinese boondocks, for me, it was paradise.
I don't know. I'm an assistant professor without tenure, so writing is my marsh. But it was a lot of fun working with Orville, you know, and I think the co-authorship added a huge amount for both of us. On your question about, I mean, it's...
You're also an expert on North Korea, and I want to somehow get that into the conversation, because we have spent many programs trying to analyze the relationship, particularly between North Korea and China. But I'm sorry, you're going to...
Oh, yeah. No, happy. Always happy to talk North Korea. But, you know, on this issue of sort of how we feel as non-Chinese talking about China, and Orville and I have talked about this, and watching the reaction already to our book, we can see sort of these two, almost a yin-yang response. One response is quite defensive, a sort of how dare you talk about us, especially at a kind of national psyche level, you know, which you can understand. And then there's another side that's actually quite fascinated by how outsiders, and I think in particular Americans, see China. You know, so an example of that is whenever I'm in Beijing, I'll go to my favorite bookstores, and I'm every time amazed at how I can see the most recent publications on Qing dynasty history in English, because they've already been translated and are lining the shelves at the good bookstores in Beijing. So they're fascinated by how they're seen, and they're open, you know, in the way that Americans read de Tocqueville.
Well, I was just going to mention, you mentioned Montesquieu, and yeah. I was thinking of Tocqueville because that was essentially seeing America through foreign eyes, and we continue to quote him, and Gunnar Myrdal, for that matter, you know, a Swedish sociologist who came here and wrote America's Dilemma, and so it goes. I want to talk about this trajectory, though. I'm looking at Paul Krugman's article that appeared July 18th in the New York Times. He said, secretive government, controlled press, sheer size of the country, it's hard to figure out what's really happening in China than in any other major economy, but he says China's in big trouble. And bases this on, and a number of economists are, the need for the economy to have more consumption than innovation, and the fact that the economy seems to be off course, not so predictable, but in serious debt problems. So here you have China, power, money, and so forth, second most powerful. Downward slide. I mean, a lot of economists, a lot of really fine economists like Krugman are saying it's definitely on a downward slide.
You know, before addressing that, let me say one thing about de Tocqueville et al. When he came here, he was basically admiring of us. Mm-hmm. Mostly when Chinese are confronted by foreign analyses, they're much less admiring and more critical. And of course, that's the historical pattern. Chinese preying upon China, criticizing China, occupying China, exploiting China. So there's a very different dynamic of sensitivity.
Well, John said he used the word coldly looked at China, that you both, like Yeats, cast a cold eye.
We try to keep an objective perspective. I mean,
but you have a warm feeling for the people of China.
I'm married to a Chinese. I have a certain investment. As to the Krugman argument of late that China is on the precipice. Neither John or I are economists, and it's very hard to to know whether Krugman is right. But I would say one cautionary word. We both have been around this block a few times, and I don't know how many times you could count them, but probably on four hands, when China seemed on the precipice. It didn't seem like it ought to work. And by any rational analysis, it shouldn't have worked. But what I think we've learned is, and this gets back to the notion we've talked about of a different model, there is something somewhat different going on here. Maybe not for all time. Maybe it'll still come a cropper. But this has been one of the most extraordinary quarter of a century.
But there is slower growth. There is economic slowdown
growth.
Now, yeah.
But that doesn't mean that the end is nigh. No. It could, but it doesn't necessarily.
Well, we're coming up on a break, and I want to give listeners an opportunity to join this conversation. Your thoughts about China, really, I think the two co-authors who are here with us have done an extraordinary job of giving us a sense of why China has become such a powerhouse and looking at the history of China. And as I said, there are really 11 biographies here and 11 featured iconic figures of different sorts, and we can talk about them individually. But I'd really like to get your read on this, that is, you as listeners, and how you see this developing, particularly invite those of you of Chinese heritage or who have connections or economic interests in China. Actually, we all have economic interests in China. Our toll-free number is available, and we welcome your phone calls. It's 866-733-6786. If you'd like to join the conversation, again, we invite you to do that. 866-733-6786. Feel free also to email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any comments or questions you have at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. This is Forum. We'll return with John DeLurie and Orville Schell. Their book is out and it's available. And actually, we're going to talk about some places that they'll be as well. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. When he first visited Beijing back in 1975, Orville Schell noticed a country that lacked advertisements, private cars, and private property. And today, China possesses the world's second largest economy. Orville Schell is director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society, here with us in studio with his co-author John DeLurie, a senior fellow at the center, discussing how China rapidly climbed the global economic ladder in their new book, which is called Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. And they'll be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at Stanford's Cubberley Theater in Palo Alto. That's a Commonwealth Club event. Also speaking tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at the World Affairs Council on Sutter Street, but that event is already sold out. an opportunity for those of you listening to join us in this conversation. You can do that also by going to our Facebook page or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. We'll get your thoughts about China and essentially this thesis. And we're not only talking about the thesis of how China has come along from being known as the sick man of Asia and going through all that humiliation after the Opium Wars to being this economic powerhouse, but what was really behind it and what led to it, and also talking about 11 figures. And we should at least spend a moment on some of those figures here. I mean, how'd you come to the decision to get this? It sounds like a football team, but this 11. We've got one woman, too, the Empress Dowager.
Well, a couple of people stayed on the bench. Unfortunately, some of our favorites never got out on the field.
Got to edit, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were trying to find people who, in some cases, Westerners would know, but in other cases, they would not know, who we felt had something interesting to say and represented the period in which they lived, so we could follow sort of the main currents of history and intellectual thinking from the middle 19th century till the present.
Yeah, and you know, it goes back to your question, Michael, about what's the philosophy of history behind this, and is this great man of history? And you know, in some ways, we alternate between thinkers and leaders. So some of the figures we chose, like Wei Yuan, you mentioned, and the second one, Feng Guifun, they are influential in their way, but we chose them more because they're powerful observers. You know, they're acute observers.
And seminal, really.
Yeah, that's right. But in some cases, they're seminal a bit later down the road. The other group are the names that our readers might, you know, more likely to know, like Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong, who do fit great man of history model and great woman of history model. I mean, the Empress Dowager Cixi, I remember it was Orville who sort of pushed that on us, and I was initially not so sure, reflecting my, you know, academic historical biases, because scholars have really avoided Cixi, and there's still no scholarly biography of her. But we went with that, and the more we worked on it, the more we realized she is such a critical figure. She is the paramount political figure from 1861 until 1908. So how can you tell modern Chinese history without looking at this person? Now, in many ways, her significance is through what she failed to do rather than what she did. But she emerged as someone who is now such an obvious choice to us, although at the beginning of the project we might not have thought.
Seemed like an obvious choice to me as a reader.
Glad you liked it.
Let me just ask you, though, since I brought it up, and then we'll go to our callers and find out what's on their minds. Any questions or comments, again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us at forum@kqed.org. Let's just talk for a brief few moments about North Korea, though, because I know that's been a great interest of yours, John. And as I said, we've gone back and forth on this program a number of times, particularly when missiles were launched, about what kind of suasion China actually has on North Korea. I mean, on the present regime particularly, but even the previous regimes. And it's been debated because obviously there's a tremendous sense of dependence upon China, I mean, just in terms of food and resources by North Korea. But there's also been the sense particularly that North Korea, well, is trying to maybe keep, that China's trying to keep North Korea under a kind of control that maybe it has or it doesn't have. How do you read it?
Yeah, well, you know, my perspective on this is unusual since I'm an American living in South Korea who studies China and goes there a lot and also has been able to visit North Korea about four times over the last 5 years. So I try to see it through these four perspectives. And on your question, one pattern I see is that Americans will typically look to China in a crisis moment, like North Korea is about to launch a missile, and then say, okay, China, do something. And U.S. diplomacy in particular, since the George W. Bush administration, has in some ways outsourced our North Korea diplomacy. We don't like to sit down with them directly. We like to sort of do it through Beijing. And I think the pattern shows that doesn't work. China does, and the Chinese are always saying this, we're just not buying it. But I believe the Chinese when they say we don't have that kind of leverage. Now, where China can have an influence on North Korea is a much slower process that in some ways is a version of what China's gone through over the last three decades, which is opening up the North Korean economy, drawing people out. You start with government officials, but then you start to work down the line, drawing them out so that they understand what the global economy, what their regional economy is about. And so you use the power of economics to slowly moderate their foreign policies. And that is indeed what happened with China. So when I ask Chinese a question that many Americans have, why doesn't North Korea just do what you do? Why don't they keep their one-party state? You know, they have a Communist Party too, but get their economic act together. And the Chinese answer is they are doing what we're doing. We first had to establish our security. We got a bomb under Mao. We got normalization with the United States when Nixon visited. And then we turned to economics under Deng Xiaoping. So the Chinese say the North Koreans are on that precipice, but they need to feel secure. When you make them feel secure, then they can shift toward economic development. That's so it's a very different perspective.
That is a different perspective.
And Michael, I should say that there is still in China tremendous frustration with North Korea, growing frustration. I mean, they really, I think, feel very sort of, you know, almost like they'd rather not have to be involved, but they're stuck with it because they share a border.
This is their prodigal child?
This is their kind of crazy uncle locked in the attic.
Crazy uncle.
And, you know, they don't quite know how to deal with it. And actually, I think the uncle is just crazy enough that it doesn't really want to listen to China any more than it wants to listen to us. So China doesn't want to actually acknowledge that its influence is limited as much as it is, because it makes China look ineffective. So there's a lot of very complicated dynamics going on here.
Speaking about complicated dynamics, we're going to go to your calls here in just a second. I want to get Orville Schell's take on something. Now, I'm looking at the most recent issue of the week. Let me just read this to you. It's quite a portfolio. Chinese firms now own IBM's personal computer division, Volvo, purchased from Ford, an AMC movie theater chain, and Virginia-based pork producer Smithfield, as well as large stakes in Devon Energy, Chesapeake Energy, two of the biggest U.S. natural gas and oil companies. So far this year alone, Chinese companies have spent $10 billion on U.S. deals, compared with less than $1 billion in all of 2008. That doesn't yet put China among the top 10 nations for foreign direct investment in the United States, but the trend is steep and China's buying potential is enormous. And they go on in another script to talk about how, guess who dominates the oil industry in Iraq? China. Guess who's, I mean, and of course we know about China and Africa and the Sudan and so forth, but all of this goes back to what Krugman says about all this investment. It's buying, buying, buying and investing, even here in the United States, without necessarily moving toward consumption or trying to, I suppose, do what innovative marketing ought to be doing, perhaps, from the perspective of better economics.
Well, I think Chinese companies, like any multinationals, want to move up the value chain. And they also want to acquire some global brands. And this means investing abroad. Chinese investment in America is still now on a par with New Zealand and Denmark. Very small. But there's a giant sort of tidal flow of investment that's seeking now to get out of China and go someplace. And we see this in the Smithfield Ham deal that's not been signed yet, but I think likely will be. And I think actually we tend to look at this in a somewhat threatening light, but it actually in most cases has nothing to do with national security. And probably would be to the great benefit of America, just as when the Japanese came in the 80s, ultimately it was to the great benefit of America. And now 700,000 jobs created by Japanese companies. And I wager that the Chinese new investment here will create a similar circumstance.
We're talking with Orville Schell and John DeLurie. They are co-authors of a new book called Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. And it's been a little bit of a long march here, but let's get to our callers. Neil, you're first up. Good morning.
Yeah, a couple of questions. Are you familiar with the earliest Chinese dissident works, like the 36 Way or Prisoner of Mao? And if so, what did you think of them? The second question is, where does Taiwan fit in all of this? Couldn't Taiwan serve as a model for Chinese economic development? And isn't there a word for, how do we put it, authoritarian capitalism? Isn't that called fascism?
Well, I think what you're referring to is what we alluded to earlier, is that this new model of sort of authoritarian capitalism, which has certain similarities with fascism, yes. And I think, you know, this is very much in the line of what we historically found over the last 150 years, namely China searching around for what works. Not a lot of idealism here.
It's pragmatism.
Pragmatism. They had their big idealism in the Chinese Communist Revolution, big visions of utopia. It failed. And now nobody wants to do the vision thing.
What was the work you asked if they were familiar with, Neil?
36th Way or Prisoner of Mao, two of the earliest works by Chinese dissidents published in the 1950s.
Anybody know it?
36.
No, I think we're coming up with blanks, Neil, but yeah. Thank you for the call. I want to get also to more calls, and Phil is our next caller. Good morning, Phil. You're on forum.
Good morning. In the first page, in the last pages of Henry Kissinger's 2011 book on China, he points out that the arrogance and the self-centeredness of Great Britain and Germany led not only to World War I, but also to World War II. I'm wondering if the self-centeredness and arrogance of China and Japan can lead to World War III. And secondly, if China and Japan can have the reasonableness that Germany and Great Britain have now to lead to a European Union, a United States, an Asian Union, or a United States of Asia. Is that a possibility?
Well, they're fighting over territories as we speak, I believe. China and Japan are.
This is John. It's a very good concern, and it's something actually I'm not worried about World War III, but I think and over the course of doing this book and scrutinizing the history of the Sino-Japanese relationship and also visiting China over the course of this territorial dispute and seeing how quickly Chinese across the generations, this is from young Chinese to older Chinese, how quickly their anger can be released toward Japan.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I mean, you just think about Japan refusing, as I think has been true about like such things as teaching the Holocaust in parts of Austria, to teach the Rape of Nanking, to actually teach that in history classes. Well,
no,
why not?
That's right.
The comfort women.
Exactly. I live in South Korea, and this is a weekly issue where the dwindling numbers, you know, there are less than 100, I think, comfort women, sex slaves, are alive, you know, and these elderly women trudge out to the Japanese embassy every week in Seoul saying, you know, address us. So this is a very difficult issue, and the dynamics are quite different. You know, Orville and I as Americans, I think our primary lens is U.S.-China relations, but it's a very different mix, and I think a much more toxic mix of Sino-Japanese relations, because the hatchet is not buried. And Chinese feel, and many would agree, I would probably agree, feel Japan has not done its work to deal with the history of its aggression. Its aggression in China was so much more violent than anything that happened between, say, the United States and China, that there is a danger. And I think that's why, Kissinger drew attention to that in his book. And I think watching this dispute over a tiny set of islands progress month after month, even year after year, is causing a lot of concern.
Reminds me of the Falklands, the Malvinas in some ways. I mean, it's much deeper than actually the territory. It's historical. Actually, speaking about historical, Mark, one of our listeners asks, I keep hearing Mr. Schell and Mr. Delury both repeating the word humiliation. We often hear about the idea of face, but would either of the authors elaborate on why this is so important in Chinese culture? Has it always been such an overarching element in Chinese society? Is there something about this concept that we in the West don't fully understand?
It's an interesting question. And strangely, Michael, there has been no book that's really of consequence written about the idea of face in Chinese culture. And yet, as the caller points out, it's an extremely important sort of element in understanding why the U.S. and China and Japan don't get along and what it is that makes things so sensitive.
I see it, honestly, as a form of honor, really, isn't it?
It is a form of honor. And to sort of understand honor, particularly of a country that was once so great and had no reason to even question its greatness, for that country and people to have fallen from that state of grace to what they did by the beginning of the 20th century was something that you sort of never get over. And then, of course, the Chinese Communist Party and the Nationalist Party, I should say.
I hate to flog my own thesis here, but I see the same elements in some of the Islamic radicalism,
yeah,
saying we were the great empire. And, you know, now there are these towering places in New York City that should
this
come
is powerful
down.
Stuff. And what, of course, the Muslims have not yet confected that the Chinese Communist Party and Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalists did was a whole national narrative of a unified country based around the idea that you were humiliated, victimized, and exploited.
Which brings back Taiwan, Neil brought up, and also brings Tibet into the picture as well. I mean, that's part of FACE, isn't it, John?
Yeah, we can get back to those two, but I just want to add something, which is, and I suppose you could say this is a hopeful possible twist, this notion of humiliation and the way in which it's defined the Chinese national narrative, you know, it's ultimately something to be transcended and to be overcome. So according to their own narrative, the Chinese don't want to be eternally humiliated. They're trying to claw their way out of this condition. And we found a fascinating, you know, your caller asked what's specifically Chinese here. And we found in some of these Confucian texts that go back a couple thousands of years, extensive discussion about humiliation, but in a particular way, which is that you have to be humiliated and feel your humiliation, your inferiority to others. Once you start to feel that, then you begin to strengthen yourself. Then you begin to improve yourself. And Confucianism is very much an ethic of self-improvement.
That makes me think of Lao Tzu even. I mean, it goes way back, ancient times.
No, that's right. And so this is deeply rooted in Chinese ways of thinking. And then it reemerges in the modern period, in a period where nation states are now competing and to some extent empires competing. Everyone's competing in this. You know, the Chinese were very attracted to social Darwinism. Because when they first read it, because they said that exactly explains the world we're now finding ourselves in, you know, by the late 19th century. But my point is that there
Chinese
is some
so many Republicans in the United States.
The point is there's some hope. And in fact, according to their own narrative, they are supposed to wean themselves of humiliation one day once they've gotten back up to the top.
And we're talking to the co-authors of a new book called Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century, John Deluria and Orville Schell. And T.H. Lucy writes, I really admire Schell. I'm hoping his new book, a co-authored book, also examines the steep cost of China's climb up the economic ladder and how many hundreds of millions of people were left out of that climb as the income gap grew, despite fears in the United States of China's new power, reminiscent of irrational U.S. fears of Japanese power back in the 1980s, most Americans don't understand the profound social, economic, and environmental problems facing China. Can China grow all its own food? Can its engineers magically create clean water out of toxic industrial sludge? And how many incidents like the massacre at the market wherein native people retaliated against a government-engineered influx of Han people into an already taxed economic environment are simply not reported?
Well, I think, you know, the caller really does point out something that we should never lose sight of, that in this extraordinary period of economic growth and infrastructure building, there are amazingly deep and systemic weaknesses. And things have happened so rapidly and so sort of helter-skelter that, you know, whole areas of life like the environment have been grievously harmed. And all of this stuff is going to have to be dealt with. And it's going to be a daunting challenge for the Chinese Communist Party to do that. But should the whole thing fail today, still one would have to say they've had a hell of a run. And they've laid down a pretty amazing infrastructure. Whether they paid for it with loans that come a cropper further down the line, that's another question. So will they be able to kind of keep this onward and upward trajectory that they've been riding for 25 years? I doubt it for forever. They're going to have some big bumps in the road. And that is where their system, their model, is going to be most seriously tested.
Another, listener named Beth writes, China seems to take education more seriously in many ways. They, along with India, are producing more college graduates with science, engineering degrees, while the United States lags behind even Germany, it seems. Between the end of World War II and the 70s, we as a nation were number one in science and engineering and university graduates. Now we rank below any Western developed country in various studies. And meanwhile, conservatives in and out of Congress don't seem to care. My question is why?
Yeah, this is a tough one because it gets into, you know, and sometimes this kind of discussion is useful and then sometimes its utility reaches a dead end in terms of comparing an issue like education in China and the United States. you know, I would say one point, and I'm all for education reform in the U.S., to be sure. But, you know, if you look at Chinese, if their parents can afford it, if their kids can get in, they will go to an American university any day. I mean, there's now a small trend of some of the top elites choosing to stay at their top schools more for political connections, not for the quality of education. And I say that having taught at Chinese universities and with great respect for what they do. But the reality is, from the Chinese perception, they still want to come here, at least at the university level. And on the bigger scale, I mean, still for China, this is an area where they need to make huge improvement in terms of their educational system, you know, the sort of K through 12 educational system. So I think for Americans who are frustrated with our problems in education, there's a limit to how much we can look to China as a solution.
Or Japan, which in the 80s, again, we were looking toward. Let me bring another caller on. John, that's you. Good morning.
Oh, thank you. The segment, The Road to Mandalay, was a segment on Victory at Sea, a series that they put on after World War II. And the segment deals with Japan's invasion of China during World War II and the fact that we were natural allies to both India and China, and we came to their aid. They had no army, no navy, nothing. Their defense was burnt to earth and just running to the interior of the country of China. And we built a pipeline into the country, the Lashio Highway, in an effort to save basically China, because I guess the military planners realized that with the conquest of China by Japan, they would then attack Russia from the east. And basically, I think now we'd all be speaking German or Japanese had that happened. They realized how critical China was to our survival. And we are natural allies with them even to this day. The commander at that time was Chiang Kai-shek, who fled to the island of Formosa, Taiwan, as it's called.
Okay, John. Thank you for that bit of historical analysis. And I want to go to some more emails here. Listener writes, both China and the West are running pell-mell down a road of more and more consumerism and growth. China doesn't have to deal with the slow, gritty wheels of democracy, so it has a completely unsustainable level of growth. But both economic systems are depleting and destroying the very substance and breath atmosphere of the planet. China recognizes this probably better than the U.S., but they have 1.3 billion people to feed and half the country to bring out of poverty. How can China, indeed all of us, stop this incessant economic growth, which is soon going to tip the planet into irreversible climate change, which will shred the fabric of civilization? Without a stable climate, growth will be cut off at the knees.
Well, all one can say is, yes, there's a certain truth to that, and it's quite alarming. I would say, just as a footnote, though, that China does not have the kind of culture war that we have between sort of the voodoo religious right who doesn't believe in either science or climate change as a reality. This is a government largely led by technocrats, scientists, and engineers. So from that perspective, China has a certain advantage. They don't have to argue for 10 years over a climate bill and then not pass it. Will they do anything about this? Two thoughts. First is,
especially with coal.
Yeah. I think the problems of conventional pollution, even though they're horrendous in China, that's water, soil, air, are a little less intimidating because we know how to clean those up. We've cleaned those up the world over. It's just expensive and time-consuming. The part that really does worry me is carbon emissions and climate change, because China is very unlikely to circumscribe its development simply to reduce carbon. But they will, I think, try to get more bang for their buck, so they burn less coal to get the same amount of production and thereby reduce carbon. So I think there are ways that the U.S. and China can work together. And it's a great tragedy that we've not found more ways to do that, because without the U.S. and China working together in the climate problem, there's not going to be a solution. And coal, as you pointed out, is at the heart of that matter.
A couple of listeners, bring some more substantial, I suppose we call firepower to this thesis of yours. One listener writes, I find it hard to imagine China being a substantial world power at all since they don't have a substantial navy nor any possible way to control worldwide waterways, which is necessary to be a great power in the 21st century. And another listener says, in the context of the rise to economic power, I believe it's important to acknowledge the downside that China has cultivated in the adoption of Western financial methods and technologies without addressing any environmental consequences. There's that again. Much of China's wealth results from low labor costs because of lax regulatory protections for labor and the environment. As a direct result, even their capital city now has some of the most polluted air and worse respiratory health anywhere on Earth. Economists rarely point out that the Western ideals, which led to our protective regulations, are functionally subverted by our legislative climate of globalization.
Well, there's a lot in there. I mean, on this, you know, one point about the environmental and the climate change issue that your callers are raising, I mean, it is interesting when we think about this great debate about political systems and democracy, you know, with the United States as kind of the embodiment of liberal democratic ideals, and then China as the embodiment of some sort of successful authoritarian model. Neither are very successful in confronting the urgency and severity of the climate change problem. So, you know, in some ways, maybe it's like the previous truth that capitalism leads to democracy, that there's some necessary relationship between the economic system and the political system, when in fact the two sort of happen to come together in the West, but don't have to come together and have not in a place like China. You know, similarly with climate change, it's not a political system question. It's somewhere else. And so the solution has to come from somewhere else.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. The book again, Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century, John Delury and Orville Schell, our guests. Good luck to you, gentlemen. Thank you. Congratulations on the book. Could have spent an hour maybe talking about how you worked as co-authors. That would have been a kind of fascinating interview in itself. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And we remind you, you can always continue this discussion on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Want to extend thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and the Sue Ann Gershenson Trust.